This is Foreign, Domestic, and Forbidden, the podcast about books and ideas. I'm Tim Trash.
And I am Joaquin Lobo.
And we'll be your hosts for the next hour. Joaquin, how are you?
I'm fine. You know, we had a little bit of rain this morning. I don't know why, don't ask me. It was just such a great thing to see, like, five drops of water coming from the California sky in the middle of this horrible drought. So it's a good day for me. A little bit of water from heaven.
Yeah, I'm a little north of you, and we're still waiting for it to arrive. And we're hoping that there's not going to be any lightning. 2 years ago, we had a thunderstorm, and it started two fires near here, and it was quite scary. So hopefully it's just going to be the rain. There are a few housekeeping items before we're going to introduce our special guest today. And it's just kind of the usual. Like us, subscribe to us, and give us 5-star reviews wherever they have 5-star reviews so that people can find us. It has something to do with the algorithm. The more people subscribe or like, the more people see us popping up. So if you like the show, just give us the 5 stars. If you don't like the show, give us the 5 stars so your enemies will be led to our podcast. And yeah, and that's it. And back to you, Joaquin.
So we don't do it for money, we do it for love, right?
So exactly.
We just want the love of our audience. That's
exactly. No money. There's no Patreon. You can't support the show with money. But if you want to, you can send us a yellow Lamborghini, you can DM us, and I'll give you the address, but no money involved. No.
Well, talking about love, I'm just so happy and excited today because we have a terrific guest, someone that I admire and respect tremendously, a colleague of mine, a friend, Jasmine Darsnik, who is a really interesting writer in I'm not going to say in the Bay Area because she's well known across the U.S. and her books have been translated now into many, many languages, something like 17, which is really fantastic, quite an achievement. Jasmine teaches at the California College of the Arts, where I've been teaching for the past 20 plus years. And she has brought an incredible deal of talent and energy to the college. She's published, I don't know how many books she's written, but she's published at least three major works. One of them is a memoir that was published a while ago. That would be her first major book. It's called The Good Daughter, a memoir of my mother's hidden life. And then two amazing novels. One of them, Song of a Captive Bird, that is just incredible because she took the life of one of the most fascinating figures in Iranian literature, Farrukh Farrokhzad, I'm hoping I'm pronouncing this correctly, who was, you know, really a transgressor, someone who died very young after creating an amazing body of work that I'm sure I'll probably ask, that one of my questions to Jasmine would be, what's the status of this poet right now in Iran? I'm sure that not a lot of people are reading her work that happens to be, you know, very sensual and very transgressor for a place like contemporary Iran. So that book, Song of a Captive Bird, that's probably, I don't know, I was reading a poem by this poet, and I'm wondering if the title comes from one of her poems, and that would be probably my second question to Jasmine. And the latest book, really interesting book that I'm reading right now called The Bohemians, where Jasmine took the life of Dorothea Lange, a very, very important canonical American photographer from early 20th century. And she begins with the arrival of Lange in San Francisco in 1918. And it's just such an engaging and terrific novel that I can't wait to finish it. So, Jasmine, such a pleasure to see you. Welcome to Foreign, Domestic, and Forbidden.
Oh, so terrific to be with you. Thank you so much. Excited for our conversation.
So let me begin with that first question. Tell us a little bit about this poet, this great Iranian poet, and we can just take it from there.
Sure. So Furuq, and you did a pretty good job with that pronunciation. Excellent. And she's so well known. She's known by her first name to Iranians and to those internationally, kind of like a rock star like Elvis or Madonna. You can just call her Furuq. She was born in 1935, died in 1967. It's been a couple of years. The book came out a couple of years ago, and you get so engrossed in your most recent project. But in any case, she was a real renegade. That's a perfect word for her. And she's sometimes compared to Sylvia Plath, but I think she was even more revolutionary given that she was coming out of Iran at the same time in the 1950s and didn't have the advantages that Plath had to go to university, for example. Everything was against this woman, and she was writing against everything as a result. So she became, in her lifetime, she was really vilified and had some readers, but it's after her death in a car crash at the age of 32 that she becomes this kind of larger than life figure, a voice of feminism, a voice of also political dissent, environmental consciousness. She was ahead of not just her time, but our time too. So a fantastically inspiring life shot through with all kinds of controversies and the perfect subject for a novel.
That's so interesting because I watched some films from Iran that were made back in the 60s, and it was such a different place. I mean, it was so modern and edgy, and so, you know, look in many, many ways. It reminded me a lot, for instance, like Argentina or Mexico City, you know, big Tehran, big cities with a very diverse kind of population, a lot of things going on in terms of cultural life and so on.
Yeah, it was a really fascinating period, the 60s, the 70s. Not that the conservative elements had died down, they were certainly present, but there was this flowering of the arts and the artists, you know, we're talking about Bohemia today.
Exactly.
The artists had a kind of Bohemia in Tehran. They were traveling internationally. They were going to Europe, to the United States. So there were all these really interesting cross currents that start to flower in the literature in the 60s and 70s.
I have to ask because Joaquin asked that question sort of in his intro. Has your book been published in Iran?
Yeah, it has, and it was a surprise to me because because there's no trade agreement. Of course, the U.S. has no diplomatic relation or economic relationship with Iran, and so anything that's translated from the U.S. and a lot of things are. You might be surprised that. Mm. They really do, through underground channels, they manage to publish a lot, not just of literary fiction, but commercial fiction. Books like that book, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, you know, that was a bestseller in Iran for a couple of years. You know, so yeah. it is more, you know, it's transgressive fiction, but it's also commercial fiction that that gets published, translated and published there and does really well. So I did not sell my book in Iran. The night before it was going to be released in Iran, I got a message over Instagram letting me know that, that my book was coming out and this was the title and here was the cover. And it was pretty astonishing to get that. I think as somebody who left Iran, you always have a little, there's always a piece of you in that country. I have a very deep connection to Iran. So it was terrific in a way, but also really surprising to learn that this was going to be published. And one of the reasons it Well, one reason it was published was because Furugh is such a sensation still in Iran, and I can talk to you more about her legacy, but also because after all these years that I've lived in America, Iranians really think of me as an American writer. They don't think of me as Iranian. And so I have more license in a sense. So I could take on this iconic character, this iconic figure, and write about these revolutionary aspects of her writing. And it was in a way safer than an Iranian writer writing about Furugh, writing about these subjects, because I'm viewed as a foreigner.
But do you write in Persian?
I don't write in Persian. I grew up speaking Persian. I can read it well, but it's been, I think we maybe all sort of relate to this issue of you have a writerly voice. And for me, that voice is now, that language is English.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense what you're saying about taking more liberties. That rings a bell, that somehow like writing about an Iranian subject, since you're writing from the point of view of an American writer, you have more freedom to take it on and to dive into the subject and treat it in a very different way than an Iranian writer would probably treat the subject. Mm-hmm. Very cool. Yeah.
Yeah, really, really terrific. And since then, so that was the first book that was translated into Persian. And then that book did really well in Iran. It went into several reprintings. And subsequently, my first book, which is a memoir, was also translated and published. So
cool.
Kind of interesting. I've got an interesting kind of, life going on in Iran as a writer.
Yeah.
I imagine there must be some kind of bohemian scene in Tehran that sort of manages to thrive underground, so to speak. Because, in places with totalitarian regimes, in places that are intolerant, artists and poets and writers, they always find a way, or we always find a way to get together and to exchange ideas and have a conversation.
I think that's absolutely true. And you really see it in the arts and the visual arts in Iran, which, there's really been so much exciting, interesting work created within this really impossible regime of censorship and repression, also in film. So Iranian film maybe is better known than Iranian literature at this point, but all of that expression has been born of repression. And so it's a really interesting scene in the arts, visual arts, and also literary arts, but probably better known in the West are the films of Iranian cinema.
Yeah, I wonder how someone like Asghar Farhadi, or of course Kiarostami is gone, but you still have a lot of very important filmmakers working in Iran, trying to navigate that very thin line, right, between what's possible and what is forbidden.
Yeah, and it can be, though I would never advocate for it, but it can be a really exciting place too, that thin edge that you're talking about.
Yeah, so I grew up in West Germany, but I lived in Berlin for a long time, and during the fall of the Berlin Wall, and East German artists described it exactly that way, especially in theater. I did theater at the time, and they said that because of the repression, the ensemble of one theater would really create a language with its audience, and every little wink, every word that was slightly out of place was entirely understood by the audience. You didn't have, they were speaking a secret language, basically, and they developed the language together and they pushed the boundaries together. And so, well, of course, you don't want to live in a repressive regime in order to make great art, but the collaboration between audience and artist is, I think, much, much stronger there. Whereas capitalism, I would say, and it's a very broad statement, but still has ways to erode that relationship and commercialize it, whereas in very repressive regimes, art is not always just done for money or needs a big market, but is understood by the people who practice and witness it in very different ways. And it feels, of course, and it is more dangerous. I mean, I can go out in the street and shout obscenities all day long, and maybe I'll get hauled off at some point because it's night and I'm too loud. But the protest isn't as effective as it is in other societies, because money here can drown you out and silence you in all other ways. Mm-hmm. So you can say whatever you want, but nobody's listening anyway.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And I think about the survival of poetry, you know, which in Iran is still such a part of really an essential part of people's lives, I'd say. And I think poetry is just this kind of really, really interesting vessel, because it's ambiguous, right? And so poetry for Iranians for millennia has been a vehicle for expressing what otherwise can't be expressed, right? and so I think there are even certain forms that I imagine, I don't know if this is the case in West Germany, but you're talking about theater, but I'm thinking about the role of poetry for Iranians and how it has held so much of the pain and the anger and the longing for the people.
Mm-hmm. You know, you remind me of San Francisco back in the 1950s. And, you know, we'll go back to 1918 in just a second. But I remember in conversations that I used to have with I don't know if you met Michael McClure, who died a couple of years ago. He was at CCA for many, many years. Michael McClure was one of the young poets from the Beat Generation. And he used to say all the time that back in the 50s, early 50s, it was dangerous to be a poet in a place like San Francisco. Because, you know, most people thought of you as, you know, you're a poet, you're a drug addict, and you're a homosexual. And at the time, you know, San Francisco was a very, very intolerant place in terms of, you know, being a drug addict or being a homosexual. And of course, you didn't have to be that, but that was the assumption. Mm-hmm. That you were someone who, you know, was good for nothing, that was not bringing anything of value to San Francisco society, and people could beat you up because of that. I wonder, how was it for you to imagine San Francisco back in 1918? Because right now, one of the many projects that I have, I always have all these projects, I'm working on a novel that's set in Mexico City in 1919. Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting to go back, you know, 100 years and try to see a place that has changed so much. And you have access to archives and photographs and so on. But how was it for you to recreate this San Francisco from 1918 in the Bohemians?
Mm-hmm. Well, I absolutely wanted to write about San Francisco. And it started with this romantic idea of what the 1920s were. And I think it's one of our enduring mythologies, the 1920s. I mean, it's so glamorous and glitzy and all that. And so I think I really started, I wanted to be in this world. I was writing in 2016 in America. And there's always, I think for me, some part of me that sees fiction as an escape hatch from reality. So I wanted to go back to this period of bohemian, you know, invention, reinvention and all of that. But of course you go back and you find the grittier realities. So the 1920s, I started really wanting to, you know, to really succumb to the allure of the 1920s. And I started to see white nationalism. And, you know, so I'm all of a sudden confronting a 1920s that felt awfully similar to the reality that I was living in, you know, which is inevitable. We can't just transplant ourselves to another time. You're also taking yourself with you and your times and all of that. So it was a wonderful time travel experience, but it was punctured really quickly by an understanding that there was so much about the 1920s that was less than alluring and awfully familiar to somebody living in Trump America.
Especially because one of your characters is a Chinese American. At the time, where being a Chinese American in San Francisco was also very difficult.
Yeah, and I started out, you know, I was interested in Dorothea Lange, our great photographer, but then when I saw this mention of her Chinese American assistant, and I think it's got to do with being an immigrant myself, is my imagination just fastened onto this woman. She's just a paragraph in the Lange biography, but I thought, what a curious absence. Who was she? Why did she appear? Why did she disappear? What was her world? You know, surely she had a really interesting story, but I couldn't find it. You know, that's part of also the, it's a frustration, and it's reminding me, it's actually not unlike censorship. So when you look at history or the archive, there's so much frustration about what's not there, but that can also be a place of exploration, right? A place of invention. And so this woman's very absence for me was, it wound up being truly for me the most exciting part of the project, is imagining the life of this Chinese American woman who worked with Dorothea Lange.
I love that because, you know, people who look like me or people who don't look, you know, American in that really stereotype sort of appearance, physical appearance, are constantly erased from history. We're invisible. And the fact that you chose to and erase her, I don't know what the word is, but to bring her back from that invisibility, I think is very powerful and eloquent. I love that.
Oh, I appreciate that. Thank you. And it's such a perplexing, I mean, it's such a paradox, is at once the immigrant or the ethnic person is hyper-visible, right? So she would have been hyper-visible in 1920 San Francisco. This is a segregated city. The Chinese lived in Chinatown. So anywhere she would have went, just a block outside of Chinatown. So Dorothea Lange's studio on Sutter Street was just a couple of blocks away from Chinatown. But there's no way that this woman would not have been hyper-visible from the moment she stepped into the streets. And yet there's this erasure. Right? There's this sort of looking away or a refusal to engage that also gets replicated in our literature.
How did you find during your research? So the 1920s, you said, we're still in love with, we're still romanticizing that. And I grew up romanticizing 1920s Paris and the Lost Generation and all that. And how did you find that San Francisco stacked up against that version of this time? How was it its own thing or a very different thing? I think San Francisco is always maybe like sort of in the shadow of the other hubs of bohemianism of that era. So what did you find and how did you compare it to these other hubs?
I think it was just as exciting, much less known. So I too fell in love with, I mean, that's why I wanted to become a writer, as I discovered N.I. Snin and 1920s Paris, and all of that was just, you know, I've been hooked since then. And there's less known about San Francisco. So San Francisco was really exciting. It was much cheaper. It was a place that was settled by so many outsiders. It was a place where you could reinvent yourself, even if you weren't an artist, but especially if you were an artist, it was possible to claim a life as an artist in San Francisco. And so all of that was true of the city in the 1920s. But again, I mean, going back to the things we don't know is this is part of the mythology that doesn't get written. San Francisco and California were absolutely at the forefront of white nationalism and anti-immigration. So all of the legislation comes out of San Francisco. There's so much animosity against the Asian population, Chinese especially. And this is something, even having grown up in San Francisco or the Bay Area, you don't know. I mean, we think we're innocent of the crimes of American history. Now that's, you know, that's saying a lot, but you know, it was all of that glamour, but it was also realizing that it was a far less innocent place than I'd ever known.
I love to hear that, because I always thought that white liberals in the Bay Area think they're so advanced and so progressive and so sophisticated. And, you know, after 30 plus years in the Bay Area, I've seen that that's a really deceiving self-image that many of our fellow white liberals have in the Bay Area. In reality, the Bay Area is super segregated to this day. It's dominated by class, by income. I just saw yesterday some tweet where they were talking about places in the Bay Area where you don't have any people of color living. There was a division by county, places like Alameda County, where you have this island of a well called Piedmont. There are Piedmonts like that in, you know, in every single county in the Bay Area. Yeah. People were, you know, if you're not white and wealthy, you really have no place. You're not welcome in these communities. Mm-hmm. And a proof of that, what you're saying, is what happened to the Japanese, for instance, during the Second World War. That, you know, those horrible concentration camps, internment camps, as they used to call, where thousands were put in cages because of their ethnicity. Mm-hmm. So this dark history is really interesting, I think. And we don't like to think about that history because, you know, it makes us uncomfortable. It challenges the notion that we have for ourselves. It's a very advanced place in the U.S.
It's true. It's true. Which is why I think there's a lot of potential for fiction. I think that most people are, for one reason or another, they would probably be... It would be a far smaller audience that would be interested in a nonfiction account of the same time and period. Mm-hmm. But with fiction, with a story, with one life, you know, one person's life or these two lives, you get this really this really interesting opportunity to take people with you and show them this world that otherwise they might have pushed out and away from themselves, right? So that's really interesting to me. And I had that experience too when writing about Furuq, about Iran, is I think far, far fewer people would have read a nonfiction account, but a novel written in the first person, there was something that invited people in. And I think, you know, that's not the only reason I do it, but it's really terrific when I find people who say, you know, I didn't think I was interested in this person, or I didn't think I could be interested in that, but I could make it interesting for them through fiction.
Ever since, like, we decided on talking about Bohemians and Bohemianism, although ism seems weird in the context of Bohemians, but I've been asking myself, we're looking to these times of colonies of Bohemians, and it's also this really funny history why we actually call them Bohemians. I looked that up the other week, and it was quite derogatory and used for people who French people thought came from Bohemia, the Romani people, but who were actually not from Bohemia at all, and was just a big misunderstanding. But sort of in a more modern context, we think of Bohemians as these often artists, very colorful, living on very little money, being very social and coming sort of in groups. And that might be the only parallel to the origin of the word. But but I was thinking, are there times of these artist colonies like in the loosest sense of the word, are the times over? Because I look at the damage the universities, the academy might have done to Bohemianism, or how Bohemians have drifted into the academy or spread out. And I don't know, like if I had to point right now to something similar to Paris in the 1920s or Mexico City in the 1970s, as described by Bolaño, I would draw a blank. I really don't know where that still exists. And that might be my own ignorance. But here, at least in America, I wouldn't even know where that is. There are artist colonies, like small towns here, small towns there. But really, I don't know where an important hub would be, where Bohemians are still Bohemians and not just professors of literature or creative writing, sort of presenting themselves as Bohemians, or at least being wilder than their PhD counterparts or their in biology or physics or something. But really, can we still be Bohemians? Are we still Bohemians?
Or is the question, has the MFA killed Bohemia?
Gosh, I feel really personally implicated in it. You know, so you raised the specter of capitalism. A lot of Bohemia has to do with cheap living. You know, when Dorothea Lange comes to San Francisco in 1918, she can get a room in a lodging house for, I don't know, a few dollars a week, maybe. You could get an apartment for maybe $20, $20, $30, you know. And so that's a lot of it, I think, is, you know, where could you even have a life that allowed you space? I mean, after you were done just paying the bills, certainly not in San Francisco, no. I don't think. And no. I teach at an arts college, and I think, you know, there was a time where I felt like a lot of the students wanted to stay because they thought they could, you know, and then it's become much less tenable. They can't afford it. And then they don't even want to stay because they feel like the city has been co-opted by tech in particular, you know. So I don't know where Bohemia is anymore. I can't find it in San Francisco. I know there are pockets of it that I probably just am not aware of. I am really saddened by this question. I wish I could offer you, you know, a few locations, and I'd head there today if I could, you know. But yeah. But I don't know any. But then also that question of the MFA and creative writing, and you know, there's a way, I think, yes, that whole system also has part of what we sell when we sell an MFA is you're going to have this bohemian experience that you couldn't have. You'll have 2 years to write. You won't have to worry. I don't think I have a single student who's not worried, who's not working, who's not, you know, really feeling the pressure. So to the extent that we've sought to recreate some sort of bohemia in arts degrees, MFA degrees, that's also a really dubious proposition.
I feel that even 20 years ago, that was more true than it is today. And that might be just my personal history. But when I went to my MFA program, very few of us had any intention or were illusions of making money. Mm-hmm. There were some people who thought about careers in academia, but mostly we wanted to write, and we were pretty sure we wouldn't make a whole lot of money writing. And it created a sense of community. And for the poets, it was even better. They had the best parties, the poets, because there's no money in poetry and there's no illusion that there is any money. And so they had the greatest parties, and it was always good to go to the poets' parties. I taught for many years in an MFA program and just stopped 3 years ago. And the more recent students really came to the MFA program with the idea of there's money in this and I want to make a lot of money with my writing. And so I feel that the student attitude or the general attitude towards the profession has also changed, that it's not this, all right, we're going to be outcasts, nobody will look at us, and we're going to do it anyway. But now it's a thing that people want to monetize. And so that to me eradicates bohemianism too, because then we're looking at writing as a real 9-to-5 profession with a paycheck and all that.
And I think that's part of the problem, that the MFA turn creativity into a career, fiction writing and poetry into a degree. And that's something that happened in very few places on the planet. I mean, we didn't have, probably now we do, but we never had anything that looked like an MFA in a place like Mexico or Latin America in general. People used to think of the bar and the coffee shop as a place where you go to learn about books when you engage in conversation with other writers, with poets, with, you know, with people who are into books. And you mentioned Bolaño and the Savage Detectives, Los Detectives Salvajes. And that's a fantastic example of, you know, that rite of passage in a place like Mexico City back in the 70s, which I actually experienced when I was living in Mexico in the 70s and the 80s. I mean, to the point that I know a few of those people in the novel. One of them, the main character, Ulises Lima, was Mario Santiago, a dear friend of mine, with whom I had the opportunity to, you know, do some of those crazy things that Bolaño describes in the book. And we never thought of poetry, because at the time I was a poet, we never thought of poetry as something that could earn you a single peso, because, you know, that was not what poetry was about. It was about, you know, epiphanies, and something, you know, romantic and crazy that put you in touch with the sublime and the, you know, it was totally romantic idea that we had about writing poetry and reading books. And, you know, maybe in the specific case of San Francisco, I wouldn't place the blame on the MFAs, but I definitely would place the blame on Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
The way that culture completely corrupted the artistic life of the Bay Area, the entire Bay Area. Mm. You know, you cannot say only San Francisco, you have to think about Oakland,
yeah,
and Berkeley, that used to be hubs of great artistic creativity. And every single, you know, poor maker has been displaced from this area.
And it's even true for the North Bay and Santa Rosa. The students in our MA program, they have a hard time, either they live already here or have a good paying job while they're in the program, because to move here, like for the program, is nearly impossible because it's so expensive to live here. And I won't go into my mortgage payments. I'm guilty as charged. I mean, I'm like, you know, like I got a job and I'm at the university, and today, later in the day, I'll be going to a chairs meeting and all that, you know, like I'm becoming sort of the bureaucrat. But still, I mean, we were, I think, at some point all driven. You said that, Jasmine, like that was your entry, you know, like in Yasmin. And we were all driven by this promise of companionship, kindred souls, and it's a real question. It's not like a rhetorical question. Where do we find that now? Where do we get that?
So I'm going to add just maybe a complication. I'll just add a little bit of something, which is that for me, as a woman, a girl who grew up in a very conservative Muslim home, that idea, I love this 19, I mean, I want to go right now to 1970s Mexico, Argentina, you know, but that's also, you know, the idea, I don't know if it's indebted at all to Hemingway, but, you know, that idea that you went out into the world and, you know, that was your education as a writer. That was really not possible for me. For many, many reasons, you know. And I have to say, I wish I knew of an MFA program when I was coming out of college, for example. So I graduated from college in 1994. I went to law school. You know, I was on that track, that immigrant, you know, striving path. Mm-hmm. I finished law school. And not that I would have had much to write about at that point, but, you know, just in my family, in my culture, it was unthinkable to say you were going to be a writer. And for me, academia cut a kind of path there. with compromises. I so hear you, Tim, about you know, the pressures of the real life, right? What that really looks like, the meetings, the mortgage, all of that. But I am grateful also that I found my way in, because there was nothing else from where I was coming from that gave me entree. And to the extent, I guess, you know, now I'm thinking about this question of where do I find, I feel like I don't have a large community. It's not Paris in the 1920s, but I have wonderful friendships with writers. So I have these little pockets, you know, these little bohemian morsels, or, you know, like a little patch here, a little bit patch there. And it's not enough. I wish it was my whole life, but it's really the thing that I feel saves me, you know, are these friendships that I've made with other writers along the way.
There are some folks that I have heard them express this idea that Bohemia is something that has been a really terrible profile that's been given to makers, because, you know, the idea of the poet or the novelist or the painter as a bohemian can also be very pejorative, because people won't take you seriously. Mm-hmm. That, you know, you're partying, hanging out, and somehow divine inspiration comes to you and then you write a masterpiece. And when in real life, painting or writing a novel or writing poetry is very serious, committed work that demands a lot of hours in the studio, in the office, mm-hmm. and it has nothing to do with hanging out and, you know, snorting cocaine or whatever you do when you're with your friends.
Yeah.
But I kind of resent the idea of the writer, in my case, as, you know, as a professional who sits, goes to the office and writes for 8 hours and comes up with, you know, something that's publishable. Mm-hmm. There is something that I really miss about, you know, my youth as a bohemian, as someone who was searching for companionships, talking, you know, with people for 8-10 hours into the night and into the new day, and just learning stuff that is very difficult to learn alone or in a classroom. There is something that I think is very valuable about that exchange, about that social life, for especially for a young mm-hmm. writer. Mm-hmm. And that's something that, because it's so difficult these days, you know, I'm not going to rant against technology or the isolation that, you know, people claim creates when you're spend too much time in front of the computer or the cell phone. But there is something about the way in which we live today that makes that experience of, you know, sharing all that time with other people very difficult.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's so interesting. I think it's so true. When I think of Bohemia, again, to go back to N.I.S. Nin and that first life-changing glimpse of Bohemia, she was in movement. She was in a city. She was bumping into people that she probably wouldn't have met otherwise. Everything seemed really to come to life in relationship with the city and the people that she met, you know. I've been thinking a lot about, I'd like to start to have some dinner parties. Just I should. You're invited. Both of you.
Awesome. We'll be there. I'm there. I'm so there.
Yeah, and not just with the people you see all the time, but, you know, maybe somebody that you met and you'd like to know better, and how irreplaceable that is to sit at a table other people and just look in their eyes and talk.
I know, especially after the COVID pandemic, right?
Yeah.
For 3 years, I lived in a very, very tiny town in New Mexico. And because there was really nothing there, we had only a few restaurants. There was no Indian restaurant, for example. Mediterranean cuisine was not there at all, like nothing like that. And so everybody started to create those things themselves. My wife started baking her own bread, and we made huge dinner parties where we cooked a certain cuisine that was not available like in that town. And because there was nothing there, and because the town was very small, so within like in 2 minutes you could be anywhere you wanted, people came together. And it wasn't as colorful as 1920s Paris, of course, because there's the big city you want to have around too. But that was the closest approximation I think I ever experienced, that people just said, okay, we're this group of about 30 people loosely connected, and we're just going to do things. And we're going to hang out together. We're going to have dinner parties. We're going to talk about literature, music, whatever interests us. And then after 3 days, everybody left, and nothing is left of that anymore. But I find that right now, sort of in bigger places, even here in the Bay Area, really it's getting difficult because you're checking your watch and basically, oh, now the drive will take me 2 hours. Now will take me maybe 90 minutes. And people tend to stay home more or tuck themselves away. So your idea, Jasmine, of dinner parties, all for it.
Yeah, we don't have that, you know. I'm so upset every time I used to go a lot into North Beach when that was the first place that I visited when I came in 1986 from Mexico City.
Yeah.
And my first beer I had at the Vesuvio Cafe with Lawrence Ferlinghetti, Ishmael Reed, and Andre Codrescu. That was my introduction to San Francisco, a beer at the Vesuvio Cafe with these poets. And I thought that was San Francisco. And for many years, that was San Francisco. Mm-hmm. I used to go at 10, 11, hang out at the coffee shop, talk to people. Mm-hmm. All of that is gone. You cannot go anywhere. Everything closes at 8 or 9. Mm-hmm. People go home. People don't want to talk to each other. It's not like in Latin America, or I'm sure in the Middle East, a lot of places where the coffee shop is this institution. You go and you talk about politics, about books, about issues.
Yeah.
And people, and we don't do that anymore in the US, at least in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
Jasmine.
No. And I share your, North Beach is still to me that great icon of bohemianism in the city. And physically these places are still there, but I know this is true, is the spirit is not quite lacking. I have to say, and you might laugh, I think you're going to laugh at me, but I think this is why women love their book club so much. You know, and this is a world that I was never in a book club, but I'm invited to them quite often now. And, you know, some of them are less serious, some of them are more serious, but a lot of these book clubs have been going for 20, 30 years. And for women, it's the only place in their lives where they can have these kind of, you know, any approximation of the kind of vibrant in-person exchange that you're talking about, you know. So that's been really interesting to me. And I just joined a book club.
Oh, wow. What kind did you join?
They're called the Smarty Pants. You know, we all think we're really smart. And they're really smart. And, I've only met with them 3 times. But I understand now why so many women, it's a lifeline to an intellectual life, to, you know, to a more authentic way of being than is possible for them otherwise.
I agree. When I was doing, a few months ago, I was doing promotion for my new novel, and I did a lot of book clubs through Zoom meetings, mm-hmm. and it was mostly women. Mm-hmm. In many occasions, it was only women. And it's not that it was women's book club, it was just a book club. And the people who wanted to be in the book club happened to be women. Mm-hmm. In many places in Mexico, in Monterrey, Guadalajara, Cancun, many, many cities, Mexico City, it was women. Mm-hmm. Women buying books, women reading books, discussing books, having great conversations. Mm-hmm. All kinds of women, professional, wealthy, middle class, poor. They had in common that desire to read books and to talk about them.
Yes.
And in the process of talking about books, talking about themselves and about life.
Yeah. Yeah. We didn't think we would land here, did we? But maybe the book club is the present day incarnation, or there's something.
So interesting.
There's something there, you know, that has survived.
Kind of sad that men don't seem to take advantage of that mm-hmm. at all.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Because I mean, I don't have any opportunity usually like to talk with other men or women like about literature either. I mean, like, it's not like that there's another corner of men's book clubs and they're blossoming or so. I don't, it's kind of weird why they wouldn't do that, or I don't know. That's a weird gender thing that men don't do book clubs. It's kind of sad.
Yeah, but, well, I think there are very interesting reasons for that, but I won't go there right now. But you know, I think it's also, you know, I when I go to writers' conferences, it's almost all women also. You know, I think that there's something maybe threatening about admitting that you don't know, that you need other people, that, you know, opening yourself in that way. I see it even at the writing conferences, in the MFA programs. We have far yeah. more women students than men yeah. students, you know. There's, unfortunately, I think men have really been put in this straitjacket of individualism, right? Of this sort of macho facade. I'm a woman and I'm talking about this.
No. I think you're totally right. And I think a lot of men are suffering from that, really, yes. because that role is very isolating. It makes you a very lonesome person, lonely person. And while of course, like there's a whole lot of romance with that thing. I just watched recently this not very good movie, The Gray Man, with Ryan Gosling. It's just an action flick, but it's that what you're describing times 10, you know, like, and you get shot, you get beaten, whatever, but you're standing tall and protecting everyone else, but nobody's giving you anything. Mm-hmm. You're just doling out either violence or protection. And no, I think that's horrible. And maybe we're coming around. Maybe the discussions that are currently been had like will lead to more than this individualism. But I think we're still in the middle of that, and it makes everything less fun. And but that's also not to, yeah, I'll be broad. Like, I think it's also what we're learning from capitalism to stick to our own guns, as it were, and not to not need help. I mean, whenever you need help in the United States, you're being put down. You're either like you're getting handouts, or you're weak, or any of these things. Like help is always associated with weakness, and so that's a real problem. And it's very antisocial. It's very nasty. But we have this current. We have these fantasies still of old capitalists like Carnegie and making it big, oppressing others, and then coming around and giving charity to the people you robbed of their money in the first place. And so that is still like this ideal. And yeah, it cuts down on bohemianism, which is kind of the antithesis of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. Poetry would be the opposite of capitalism. That's why we hate each other.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Well, it's time already for our FDF recommendations. Try at your own risk. Jasmine, what would you like to recommend to our listeners?
Let's see. What would I like to recommend? I really have, let's see, I'm thinking about a book about San Francisco that is not mine, but I'm currently reading with my book club, and it is Rebecca Solnit's Recollections of My Non-Existence.
Oh,
it's a
wow.
coming of age story about a young woman in San Francisco in the late 70s, 80s, and the last vestiges of San Francisco bohemia. So I would recommend that. Beautiful memoir. I don't know what the ladies think, but I'll find out tomorrow night. It was my choice for this month's book club meeting. But I think it's a really extraordinary book and recommend it highly.
Cool. Thank you. Thank you so much. Joaquin.
I'm going to recommend two books. The first one, it's a book that I adore so much that when I used to have a column writing for a Mexican newspaper, I borrowed the title of the book for my column called The Devil's Dictionary, that Jasmine mentions in The Bohemians in her novel. It was written by Ambrose Bierce, really interesting San Franciscan. There's this entire legend about Ambrose Bierce, who, having been diagnosed with a disease that was going to take his life in some San Francisco hospital, decided to go down to Mexico because a revolution was taking place, and he wanted to die fighting a war, supposed to dying alone in a bed in a hospital in San Francisco. And there is a book that was written by famous Mexican novelist Carlos Fuentes called Gringo Viejo, Old Gringo, that just, you know, in a very similar way in which Jasmine is writing her novel, she takes this real-life writer, Ambrose Bierce, and creates an entire story about Ambrose Bierce going to Mexico to fight in the Mexican Revolution, Old Gringo by Carlos Fuentes. So The Devil's Dictionary is just an amazing collection of aphorisms and mini essays by Ambrose Bierce that I recommend to anyone who wants to go back to, you know, a time where wit was not, you know, the enemy of writing in American literature. And the other book, of course, I would recommend The Bohemians by our dear friend Jasmine Darcy, that I'm enjoying tremendously. I think it's a great, great, engaging story. You know, I didn't have time to ask Jasmine all the questions I wanted to ask her, but maybe I will find some of those answers when I finish reading the novel.
At the dinner party, I'm going to throw
it.
Yes. We'll hold you to it now. Okay. It's on the record. And
Tim,
how
about you?
I will recommend Gertrude Stein's The Autobiography of Ellis B. Toklas, talking about bohemianism, where Gertrude Stein writes in the very idiosyncratic diction of Ellis B. Toklas and captures her voice, but talks mostly about herself. So it's a little odd, but she wrote in the voice of her partner of many, many years, and it has the Bay Area connection, because of course she came originally from Oakland, and so she then went to another bohemia. Gertrude Stein, The Autobiography of Ellis B. Toklas. Thank you so much, Jasmine, for coming.
Oh, my pleasure, totally. This was a lot of fun, and I can't wait to see you around my dinner table.
Cool. Awesome. Yes.
Good, Jasmine.
And thank you for listening. Thanks for spending an hour with us. And please catch us again in 2 weeks, and keep 5-star reviews coming. Bye-bye, everybody.